Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Bobby Kahn was with us back in April to talk about her debut memoir, In the Shadow of the Valley, which went on to enjoy rave reviews. And like most of us who grew up in or near Moorhead, Bobby, a Berea graduate, has a deep connection to land and life in eastern Kentucky. And that connection can be triggered by such events as the recent Netflix debut, the film adaptation of the J.D. Vance memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. And that triggering sensation brings Bobby back to Eastern Standard. Welcome, Bobby.
Thank you, Tom.
So in late December, Salon.com published a commentary by you entitled A Day of Reckoning for Big Pharma, the Elegy That Appalachia Really Needs. And you cover quite a lot of ground. We'll touch on some highlights now and then encourage anybody who would like to read the piece in full to find a link to your commentary on our homepage at esweku.org. But let's begin at the beginning. What's the premise?
Well, I kind of came to the Hillbilly Elegy story a little late. I had put off reading it for various reasons. And then when the movie adaptation came out, some folks were asking for my opinion on it and the book. And I decided it was time to educate myself. And around that same time, I had seen some headlines about the Purdue Pharma settlement. And when I saw those headlines, I was really blown away that, you know, it was happening, first of all. But I was also curious why there weren't more conversations taking place about the culpability that Purdue Pharma admits to fueling the opioid crisis. So basically, the thesis of my essay here is that the moral of Hillbilly Elegy, or the position he takes, is that a lot of our problems, if not all of them, in Appalachia are self-inflicted. And I think that position is really difficult to maintain when we know that Purdue Pharma, and I'm sure, you know, there are other bad actors, but at least Purdue Pharma admits, you know, preying on addiction and exploiting legal loopholes, exploiting the medical community, and not just vulnerable populations, but kind of creating vulnerable populations. So I think it's important that we ask these questions. Mm-hmm. You know, where does personal and cultural responsibility begin when we have behemoth companies with, you know, incredible power, specifically trying to induce these kinds of problems?
I'd like to read a passage from your essay and ask you to comment on this. It goes like this. A lot of negative responses to both the film and book versions of Hillbilly Elegy claim that it misrepresents Appalachia and perpetuates stereotypes. Other Appalachians acknowledge that they relate to the story and are grateful to see it told. What we have in common is that all of us, even, are more complex than what Hillbilly Elegy would have you believe. What makes Appalachia, and Appalachians in particular, so complicated?
Well, you know, I think that in a lot of cases, looking at the surface of Appalachia, you know, it's easy to see markers of poverty or the fact that education isn't necessarily the highest quality all the time in Appalachia. Although we have, of course, a lot of wonderful and committed educators. My father, though, for example, you know, I think if a lot of people met him, they would think he was a redneck or a hillbilly right off the bat because of the way he dresses, the way he presents himself to the world the way he talks, his accent, you know, and these are all things that have been represented in pop culture as symbolizing ignorance and, you know, not just the lack of formal education, but some sort of innate ignorance, which is also equated with moral failings, right? And that's where this concept of, you know, we need to just pull ourselves up by our bootstraps comes from, and all these self-inflicted problems. But my father, for example, is a very intelligent man. He might not make it to Harvard or Yale, but he knows how to work with electricity. He knows how to wire buildings, and that's something that he's done a lot of without having gone through a formal training process. And I know a lot of people like that, who, you know, they might not be able to present themselves as educated and intelligent in the way that the outside world recognizes, but they do possess an incredible amount of intelligence and other qualities that, you know, for example, the loyalty, fierce loyalty to family. Vance often talks about that as if it is a vice. And I think that a lot of us in the region would argue that that's a virtue, because sometimes, you know, we've created a lot of strong communities through that fierce loyalty. And, you know, we support one another.
You touched on this a moment ago, but in your essay, you asked the question, at what point do we hold people responsible for their behavior, and how much of it can be attributed to their circumstances? How do you answer that question?
I believe that we've largely been asking the wrong questions, you know, and so we end up with the wrong answers. We end up with answers like, you know, they need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, or it's because of their culture, their history, you know, that's where all these problems come from. I think if we just try to understand the history of a people collectively and look at the various like significant socioeconomic events that have occurred, then we can find a path forward. I think drug addiction is a really important subject. It's having a profound impact on Appalachia, and it has for a long time. And I've personally come to the conclusion that it's not about figuring out what individual people can be held responsible for. I think what we want to do is give people the tools to do better and to become better. And what we need to do is figure out what those tools are. And then, you know, I think a lot of people will make better choices. But because of, you know, economic pressure in this region particularly, I don't think that it's possible to disentangle the two issues of drug addiction and economic pressure. And so we have to tackle what we can, and it's a multifaceted problem. So I think we have to take a multifaceted approach.
Well, you do touch on some history in your essay that to this day many seem surprised about, and that is the tension between benevolence and control experienced in the coal towns of eastern Kentucky. Schools, hospitals, stores, all built, owned, and operated by the coal companies that paid employees in scrip, currency that could be spent only at these places and no place else. How did this arrangement end up leaving so many in the region so vulnerable to a drug epidemic?
Well, when the coal mines shut down, you know, because the majority of them were paying in scrip, when they left, there was no way for the families that remained to have any currency that was valuable anywhere other than with those coal companies. So because scrip was, you know, basically pieces of paper that only worked in their grocery stores or their whatever stores they had provided, you know, it was a closed system. So once they're gone, the system's gone, the currency's worthless. And so you have, and they took the schools and hospitals and all that with them. You know, there was no one funding those things anymore. They weren't community run facilities or institutions. So basically these families were left with bits of paper, and there was no way for that to translate into wealth that could have been saved, invested, you know, turned around and create their own facilities and institutions. So it was basically like they had to start over, you know, starting with nothing once the coal companies were gone. And the evidence of that is just still so palpable throughout the region.
You say that solutions to the region's problems don't rest in any proverbial bootstraps, but where should we be looking for those solutions?
Well, I think that, you know, economic policy is one of the main places where we need to be looking. I think that we need to be making smart and sustainable investments that help create a flourishing economy in Appalachia that is appropriate for Appalachia, which might mean that it doesn't necessarily look like the rest of the country due to our topography and due to the history and the ecological resources that we have. And I think, you know, probably a lot of the folks who live particularly in the former coal mining towns, they're the ones who are going to have the ideas about what they can do or what they should be doing and what they can transition to. And of course, that might require training and education in order for the economy to flourish and for it to really be established. But it needs to involve the input of the people who live there. And I think that is first and foremost, is creating an economy that rights a lot of these wrongs that were committed with the extractive economies. And that's probably pretty tricky. You know, you can't just extract resources for hundreds of years from an area and then turn around and say, oh, let's throw some factories in there and that's going to fix it. You know, I'm not an economic expert. I'm not a public policy expert, but I think it's the kind of thing that will take careful attention and careful thought and requires a lot of, you know, expert input, but also community input.
That's Bobbi Kahn. She's author of the memoir, In the Shadow of the Valley. And we've been talking about her essay on Salon.com. A link is available on our homepage at esweku.org. Thank you, Bobbi.
Thank you, Tom.
Something Bobbi Kahn just said is worth repeating.
Probably a lot of the folks who live particularly in the former coal mining towns, they're the ones who are going to have the ideas about what they can do or what they should be doing and what they can transition to.
And they are. In our December 24th show, we talked about the Southeast Kentucky Downtown Business Stimulus Fund, 8 organizations in the region raising and distributing more than $450,000 to throw a pandemic lifeline to the downtowns of Eastern Kentucky. Well, it didn't end with checks in the mail. There is a follow-up, the Southeast Kentucky Healthy Downtowns Initiative. For details, we put in a call to Shane Barton. He is Downtown Revitalization Coordinator with the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky. It's housed at the University of Kentucky. Shane, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Tom, thank you so much for having me today.
And first, tell us about the partnership that formed to make this happen.
Yeah, so early in the pandemic, when we started to really realize the full force of impacts that were going to be happening to in particular small businesses in Eastern Kentucky, a number of our partners came together, including us at the University of Kentucky's Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, but along with the Appalachian Impact Fund, the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, and Invest 606, really collaborated together to answer the call, to answer the need. We were hearing from many businesses that they weren't able to access many of the sort of government interventions that were available at the time. And collectively, we came together to try to create not only a program that was responsive, but a program that allowed other folks really to invest in this sort of good effort and positive momentum in a good direction.
Okay, and a full disclosure here, the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund are Eastern Standard Production sponsors. Shane, what does this initiative aim to do for downtowns and communities in Southeast Kentucky?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things with downtowns is that we know that downtowns are incredibly important. Not only do they have sort of an intrinsic value that we can't easily replicate in new developments, but oftentimes they showcase our community's culture and give us insights into our identities. And over time, this entanglement of built assets, our ingrained memories, and the diversity of uses really leads me to believe, and many of us working, that our downtowns are a great place to start. And really what this Healthy Downtowns Initiative focused on was allowing community collaboratives, so collaborations that were happening at the local level that included, you know, chambers of commerce, Main Street organizations, local governments, tourism organizations, health departments, historical societies, and a number of other entities to come together to create place-based solutions really at the intersection of economic development and public health in an effort to prepare and be better positioned for really the uncertain future that we're facing right now as we move into the spring, not really knowing what's going to happen with the current pandemic, or if our businesses are going to face future closures or new limitations placed on them for public health reasons.
And you mentioned collaboration. I know the initiative calls for collaboration among downtown stakeholders. And am I right that the key to funding these projects is to have among them a nonprofit as a lead applicant?
That is correct. The applications were actually submitted by nonprofits in the communities that really act as a coordinator, a liaison, planning things already with these with their partners. And in this was a pilot program, and in many ways, we reached out and invited a number of communities that we knew had existing collaborations on the ground. And really what we mean are, these are groups of organizations or downtown businesses that are already working together, creating new ways for people to interact in their downtowns or new ways to support their small businesses. So in many ways, it was a way to really allow some of these collaborations that have already been sort of taking place to receive the appropriate types of investments to really implement the ideas that they were thinking could be appropriate interventions for their current needs.
So for this initiative, do these stakeholders get together, get around a table, get into a conference room, or in this case, I guess they Zoom, and figure out a project that they all agree they should get behind?
I think that's one way to think about it. I will say, I don't think they're necessarily getting together in person.
Nope.
Though they may be having some socially distanced meetings. I have heard from a number of folks that they're coordinating a lot of this effort virtually. But what I will add is that in many cases, the communities that were funded, and we're talking Estill County, Harlan, Letcher, Pike, Floyd, and Whitley counties, they all have taken steps recently, in the recent past, to really embolden their downtown collaborations. Many of these weren't new collaborations that needed to think about projects. In many cases, the ideas that they generated were projects that they had already been thinking about. I often believe that many of these solutions, in particular place-based solutions, local communities know in many ways what they need, but often it's that that funding and being able to leverage other technical assistance that makes it hard to really become a reality for some of these programs. So in many ways, the collaborations represented ongoing efforts that had already demonstrated some success in downtown planning or revitalization. And this effort really allowed them to take those ideas to the next step and implement them and perhaps add some new elements that really focused on public health.
Are these funds targeted? Are there limitations on how the funds can be applied? What's covered?
So it was fairly flexible, and we didn't want to make the grant too constraining because, like I said, we really wanted to allow place-based solutions from local communities, really sort of dictating what they thought was most important. In terms of the parameters that we provided, we gave a couple examples of the types of investments that could be made. But really what we were more interested in is the partnership and believing that, you know, effective partnerships can also create sort of effective solutions. But some of the things that we offered as opportunities for funding were costs associated with expenditures that businesses may have to make to adapt to state regulations for reopening or potential reclosures. And what we're talking here are sort of curbside pickup or disposable plates and cutlery. We also offered the opportunity for new outdoor spaces and seating for our downtowns, knowing that indoor dining is really discouraged, and those sort of opportunities of close proximity really do seem to be where these spreader events are taking place. We wanted to provide an opportunity for folks to invest in places in their downtown that could provide outdoor seating. We also allowed for folks to purchase PPE or masks or other items that could keep their staff safe, including cleaning products. One of the other pieces that really stood out to me in some of the examples were things that we didn't suggest that folks invest in. And in particular, one example that sticks out to me is the idea of creating an e-commerce site for local merchants, helping those local businesses and merchants pivot to a web-based platform, knowing that sort of our brick and mortar establishments have taken a hit over the months. So there really has been some innovative solutions, but we didn't want to confine or constrain those local visions too much, as long as they were really focused on supporting economic development while also promoting public health.
Okay, we're going to get really specific in just a moment. Okay. When we look at what's happening in Harlan and Cumberland, we'll be talking with Colby Kirk about that. But before we do you envision there being a role for this initiative or one like it once we're free and clear of COVID-19?
I think so. And my hope is that what this effort will illuminate is that our downtowns really are important. And that they go beyond sort of the idea of a place, that they represent so much for us. It's not just about creating jobs and property values and improving quality of life, but it's really about creating places where we want to be. My hope is that some of the efforts aimed at bringing people downtown for safe shopping events like the one in Harlan County, or efforts in Letcher County to utilize abandoned buildings for new outdoor seating really do provide examples for efforts that downtown collaborations can move towards, not just in a pandemic mindset, but in a future mindset where we really want to cultivate communities where people want to be. And that includes our downtown areas, whether that is hosting music events or investing in the arts or just literally getting people outside and enjoying themselves. I think at least for me personally, being sort of cooped up and in the house working remotely, one of the things that I really miss is being around people. And I think that these sorts of downtown investments really showcase the opportunities, the different types of investments we can make around the region that really do help embolden our downtown communities, bring foot traffic, and hopefully additional economic development.
All right. Shane Barton, Downtown Revitalization Coordinator with the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, also known as CEDIC. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you, Tom.
So let's check in on one of these projects. Our next call is to Colby Kirk, Executive Director of One Harlan County. It's a 501c3 nonprofit entity focused on the economic development of Harlan County. Welcome, Colby.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
We just heard from Shane Barton with an overview of the Southeast Kentucky Healthy Downtowns Initiative. Now we're turning to you for a firsthand account of how it's working out in Harlan and Cumberland. First, if you would, tell us about the collaboration that had to happen to qualify for this support. Who do you have involved there?
Sure. So we've kind of developed a coalition of downtown stakeholders, is what we've called it in Harlan County. And these are partners that work in economic development like myself, but also in tourism in Harlan and Cumberland, our Main Street program in the Tri-Cities, and other community members that are involved in some of these local boards and organizations. And we work together to kind of come up with a cohesive strategy to apply for funds through the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and CEDIC. To help benefit our small businesses in the community during the COVID pandemic.
Okay. And tell us about the projects that have been made possible by this support. What are you doing?
Sure. Our biggest project would be this Healthy Downtowns Initiative. And we were able to secure $30,000 in funding to help give back to local businesses in the community. And with these funds, we awarded 20 mini grants to locally owned Harlan County businesses in our downtown areas. Grants ranging from $500 all the way up to $2,500 to help our business owners make it through the pandemic, purchase things like PPE, sanitizer, cleaning supplies, make payments on past due bills that have stacked up because of the pandemic, and modifications to their stores to make it safer to do business. And so we're really excited to be able to give some funding back and then to also celebrate the businesses. This project kind of came together around the idea of a safe shop hop at the end of it after the projects could be implemented. And so the first weekend in October, we invited folks to come and safely shop locally in our downtowns in Harlan and in Cumberland.
When those mini grants were made available and the other funding was made available, what kind of response did you have? Did a lot of people step up and say, hey, I want to take part in this?
Yes, we had almost an overwhelming response, and we wish we had received twice the amount of funds to give back as we did. But you know, we worked together to try to identify, you know, which businesses would have the bigger impact in bringing folks to downtown and helping other businesses get other shoppers. I think we had more than 50 applications, and we were able to award 20 grants. And fortunately, our organization, One Harlan County, had some additional funding come in later this year. And we've been able to award more than $120,000 to Harlan County businesses since May of 2020. And that's gone a long way to help our local business community.
What kind of feedback, I'm wondering, are you getting from the public? Are people really happy to see these things going on in their downtowns?
Yes, the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive to us. Most of our local businesses have been glad to know that there are organizations like One Harlan County and others who are working to help make sure that they survive. Because we know that our businesses are important to us, and they're what bring people to visit our community, and they're what make our downtown so special. And so we've had a lot of positive feedback where folks have been very appreciative of our efforts to support them.
Well, Colby, we're still in this pandemic, and it doesn't look like it's going away for at least months to come. Do you have plans to continue with this initiative?
Yes, sir, absolutely. I've written several grants this year to try to get additional funding to support our local community. At this time, we have some funding available for small businesses. We're calling it a local recovery fund, and this has been a partnership that we're working with the Harlan County fiscal court at this time to use some funding from CARES Act to help support businesses as they continue to have to, you know, spend extra costs on cleaning supplies and PPE. And so we are accepting applications. You can find those on our One Harlan County Facebook page. And we're looking forward to keep securing additional money to make sure that our Harlan County businesses are supported as long as this pandemic lasts.
All right, that's Colby Kirk. He's Executive Director of One Harlan County. Thank you so much, Colby.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break.
It's tough to convince people who have been propagandized for so long to turn away from that propaganda.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
You can listen to previous editions of Eastern Standard online at esweku.org. Navigate to our archive tab and take a deep dive into our programs. You can take Eastern Standard with you wherever you go with the WEKU mobile app. Easy to find in your app store. Just search for WEKU. You can listen to previous editions of Eastern Standard online at eswku.org. Navigate to our archive tab and take a deep dive into our programs. Curious about something? Have a topic to suggest for our consideration? You can email your idea to es@eku.edu. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
NPR, MSNBC, NBC News critic Eric Deggans is keynoting the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series on February 11th. Eric is also author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. It's a look at how prejudice, racism, and sexism fuel some of the elements of modern media. Eric Deggans, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, for your Black History and First Amendment keynote on February 11th, you're going to talk to us about how changing demographics affect media coverage of race. First, if you would talk to us about those shifting demographics, what do the numbers tell us?
Well, you know, of course, what we're seeing is that communities across the country are becoming more diverse, and we're seeing people of color push out from the urban centers where they've often dominated into suburban areas. For example, if you look at how Georgia flipped from being a safe Republican state in presidential elections and in senatorial elections, the way that flipped was that there was a concerted effort to get younger people and people of color in the suburbs around the urban centers throughout the state to come out and vote for Democratic candidates. And so what we're seeing is, as people of color sort of push out into the suburbs, that these communities that had traditionally been assumed to be mostly white and to be mostly aligned towards white culture and aligned even towards more conservative political options have suddenly changed and gotten a little broader and a little less predictable politically and in terms of the media they consume and they're interested in as well. And so it's been interesting to sort of see how the diversification of the nation has changed some of these expectations that we've had about politics and media. And I think it's also, it's energized people who are advocates of inclusion and diversity, but it's also energized white nationalists and people who are opposed to that kind of diversity in America. So I think that's one reason why we've seen this cultural friction intensify.
In your book, Eric, Race Baiter, you note that today's fastest-growing news programs and media platforms are fighting hard for increasingly narrow segments of the public, and they're playing on those old prejudices and deep-rooted fears and using some of the very same tactics that were once used to mobilize political parties. Can professionally reported, vetted, and edited journalism survive in these conditions?
Well, you know, I certainly hope it can, but if we've learned anything from the last few years, it's that there is a market out there. There are a lot of people who are more interested and watching a news outlet that will tell them what they want to hear, that will reassure them that the way they want to see the world is the way the world is, whether or not that's true. And that envelope got pushed more and more during the Trump years until we got to the point where, you know, there was a free and fair election. You know, more than 60 court challenges revealed that there was no evidence of voter fraud, a widespread voter fraud, no evidence of enough irregularities to even hint that any electoral outcome should be overturned. And yet, you know, there's a sizable percentage of people in this country who believe that somehow the election was stolen from Donald Trump because people were allowed to vote fraudulently. And one of the reasons they believe that is because there are media platforms out there that call themselves news outlets that have told them that, from Fox News to Newsmax to One America News to Breitbart to Rush Limbaugh to Mark Levin. You know, they are on television, they are on the internet, they are on social media, and they are on the radio. And they have become so invested in telling people what they want to hear and telling people things that are politically advantageous for the side that they're supporting, that it's crossed into the realm where they are straight up lying to people. And I'm convinced the only way to really stop it is to remove the profit that comes from trafficking in that kind of talk. If there's a way to turn to these media outlets that have chosen to pretend that lies are the truth and remove their advertising revenue, pressure big companies to say, do you really want to support media outlets that encourage people to attack the Capitol building, that encourage people to believe lies about our electoral system and lies about the victory of President Biden? You know, does Procter & Gamble or McDonald's or Nike, do they really want to give money to these media platforms that are essentially attacking our democracy and attacking our common notions of what is truth and what is fact? I think if people who advocate for the truth can convince advertisers to stop supporting these platforms, then these platforms will be forced to be more rigorous about the facts that they present. From my standpoint, even though ideologically I disagree with some of these outlets, it's not really about a difference of opinion on politics. It's about insisting that they be factual, that they be honest brokers. You can have an opinion about something, but still be fair about how you arrived at that opinion and be honest about the facts that led you to come to that opinion. And in fact, that's what's required of ethical opinion journalists, are supposed to use actual facts, not made up facts, not things that they wish were true, not things that are some kind of rumor on social media that can never be proven, not things that are asserted by people who are not reliable witnesses. You know, when it gets to the point where anyone can stand up and say something, and if it fits a narrative that a big media outlet prefers, they suddenly get plastered all over media and treated as if their words are true, when either they haven't been vetted or they're demonstrably untrue. That's when, you know, the commonality of facts starts to break down, and we get to this point where we can't even agree on simple facts. So I don't think government regulation can achieve it. I don't think we should be trying to establish any kind of commissions. I think what needs to happen is that, you know, we need to turn to advertisers in our business community and say, you have to be more careful about the media outlets that you are supporting with your advertising dollars. And once the profit starts to shrink at Fox News and Newsmax and One America News Network, they will be forced to be more careful about what they broadcast.
And what about the responsibility of the consumer of news? What about media literacy in education?
Well, certainly that's important. And I always feel that journalists should be trying harder to communicate to average citizens how we do what we do. I think that's a big problem. When people see a story that is a big revelation. You know, for example, this isn't necessarily the best example, because I think when the New York Times broke big stories about Donald Trump's taxes, first they had a bunch of financial documents that weren't his tax returns, but a lot of financial information on him, and they did a series of stories about that. And then they got a hold of his actual tax returns and did a series of stories about those. They tried to be somewhat transparent about how they reported on that material. They couldn't reveal where they got it from. They had promised the source that they would not reveal their identity, but they were able to talk about how they reported out and verified those documents. But in a lot of stories, we don't do that. We come up with these big revelations, you know, asserting that, you know, Donald Trump called certain African countries, you know, a curse word that was demeaning. And then, you know, the reader says, well, you know, how did you know that? And you can't necessarily disclose your source, but you can do a better job of telling people how you verified that information and why you felt it was accurate to publish, even when the Trump administration denied that he said it. And so I think journalists have a role in this. But I also think that the audiences for some of these outlets, you know, Fox News in particular, One America News in particular, Newsmax in particular, they have been propagandized for many years to believe what these outlets are telling them, even as the outlet's message has gotten more and more extreme, more and more right-wing, and less connected to the actual facts, in part because they were following Donald Trump's lead. So one of my hopes is that now that Trump is no longer president, that these news outlets will pull back a little bit and devote themselves more to actual facts. But I also think that it's tough to convince people who have been propagandized for so long to turn away from that propaganda. I mean, in our past, the way that's happened is that somehow something big that cannot be denied impacts the country, and people have to wake up and realize what's fact and what's not. You know, years ago, it was the Great Recession, and it kind of woke people up into realizing that, you know, all of this political intrigue over, you know, minutiae was not going to address the financial calamity that was destroying our economy. This time, it should have been coronavirus. It is obvious that mitigation techniques work, wearing masks works, social distancing works. Why did that become a political issue? And why are there so many people that still refuse to believe the science? You know, normally what should have happened was when something that big came from outside the political discussion and impacted the country, people should have realized, you know, these petty fights that we're having about whether or not to wear a mask or whether or not something should be locked down, they need to go by the wayside. We need to focus on what's important to safeguard as many people as possible. But that didn't happen, in part because our political leaders didn't do that, and in part because these news outlets that were profiting off of a propagandized audience wanted to stay on the good graces of the president, and they kept broadcasting this specious information. And so now we have to finally, at long last, acknowledge that the unwillingness to face the truth has cost lives in this country. So I'm hopeful that we can go to the audience and ask them to be a little more responsible. But in the face of a pandemic that has now killed over 400,000 people, there are still a lot of people out there who will not recognize the truth about that virus. So I am not hopeful that we're going to be able to convince those people to change their belief systems or to trust the news outlets that they trust less than they already do.
Yes, belief systems can become pretty hardened and pretty rigid, can't they?
Yep.
Eric, just one quick question, maybe not so quick, but it's a crystal ball question for you. Given how media shapes society in a big way, in what big noticeable ways might American culture eventually reflect the demographic change that you've been talking about?
I think we're already seeing it in that a lot of outlets that create scripted television and fictional programming are much more interested in being diverse and inclusive. CBS the broadcast network that probably over the years has been most criticized for being resistant to diversity and inclusion and for having a long roster of crime shows and dramas that feature white male protagonists. They promised this past year that 50% of their unscripted projects and 50% of their scripted projects would not only feature stars of color, but they would also be created and developed by non-white producers and writers and behind the scenes professionals. And I think that's really important because I think for a while, CBS and other companies like it saw their profit as a result of being able to appeal to a certain kind of media consumer, and that media consumer was white. And now I think they realize that the audience has grown more diverse, and if they want to stay in step with their audience, they have to provide shows that look more like the environments that people live in, or the environments that they want to live in. And so we've seen scripted television, make a lot of progress on this front. Unscripted television, and by that I mean so-called reality shows. I hate using that term because they're highly manipulated and they're not exactly reality. But if you don't say reality TV shows, people don't know what you mean. So right. Unscripted reality TV shows, docuseries, things like that, they've been slower to get the message, but they are also moving in that direction this year. The Bachelor, a reality TV romance show that has long been criticized for its lack of diversity, finally featured its first black man as the star. And even though it's one of the lowest rated seasons of the show, there is a sense, at least, that they're willing to be more diverse in what they're presenting to people. So there is hope that media outlets are trying to be more inclusive, again, because that's where the profit is. And if there's anything that my book tries to get at, it tries to get at the idea that the systemic racism that is involved in some of these media outlets using prejudice and stereotypes and sexism to appeal to viewers, it isn't necessarily about some guy sitting in a corporate suite saying, you know, I hate women, or, you know, I think my race is better than everyone else, so this is the programming I'm going to create. It's more a very cynical attempt to draw some viewers in and super serve them their vision of the world and try to keep those viewers from going to any other platform. Years ago, you know, to say 15 or 20 years ago, the way news outlets competed with each other is they would say, you know, we'll get the news faster, or we have sharper analysis, or we have better reporters. They would never look at another news outlet and say that news outlet is lying to you. That news outlet is so biased towards Democrats that you can't trust anything they tell you. But Fox News made an impact by doing exactly that, not only saying that they thought that they were a better news outlet, but that the mainstream news outlets that they were competing against were somehow dishonest with the viewers. And that's what politicians do. Politicians who are running for office turn to their competitors and tell the public, my competitor is corrupt, or my competitor is inept. And when that language gets superimposed over the competition for news outlets, then suddenly we're on uncharted territory, because often that kind of criticism is unfair, and it places a political dimension on the competition for news that I think is often misleading. You know, I can look at mainstream news outlets and say they have a lot of biases. They're biased towards conflict. They're biased towards making an impact. They're biased towards the wishes of their advertisers. But, you know, political considerations, I think, are much less of an influence than the general public actually understands. And one reason why that understanding is distorted is because there are media outlets out there that are politically biased, that are trying to convince their audience that Fox News is not the one that's politically biased, it's all their competition. Or if Fox News is politically biased, it's because their competition is all biased the other way. And both of those contentions are not true.
All right. NPR MSNBC NBC News TV critic Eric Deggans. He will be keynoting the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series on February 11th. Information about that is available online at chautauqua.eku.edu. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Signs that the hard work of courageous conversation is underway. Overcoming the fears that keep us from talking candidly, openly about our perceptions of racial justice and equality, and just the day-to-day of getting along. Well, that's happening soon in Paris, Kentucky. We learn more about this virtual community conversation from Cheryl Kasky, director of the Hopewell Museum in Paris.
Our virtual program is about giving people an opportunity to share the difficult or hard part of their history. It really comes out of just seeing, you know, occasions where people might have had their voices silenced when they try to discuss parts of their difficult past, especially when it comes to experiencing racism or prejudice within the community. And so as the local history museum, we thought that we could provide a platform where people could share their histories and their stories in an open environment. The conversation is going to be moderated by Lindrell Blackwell, who has spent a lot of time researching his family's history and has moderated similar conversations before. And so it will take place via Zoom on February 10th at 6:30 p.m. And you can find that Zoom link on our Facebook page at Hopewell Museum, or you can email info@hopewellmuseum.org to have it sent to you. It is completely free to join and participate.
Cheryl Kasky, director of the Hopewell Museum in Paris, Kentucky. Lindrell Blackwell served as moderator for a courageous conversation about a Paris lynching that took place in the early 1900s. You can find that on our site at esweku.org. Go to the archives and navigate to our July 30th, 2020 program. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org. on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.